Well, merry meet everybody, and welcome once again to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. My opening song tonight was Diversions in the Dark by Midnight Syndicate. And if you've ever read any of H.P. Lovecraft's stories, then you know what wonderful diversions they are, and some may find them a bit dark. So there you go. There's my logic for the song tonight. My guest is John L. Stedman. He's a scholar of both H.P. Lovecraft and Western occultism. He's been a magical practitioner for over 30 years, working with various covens and small groups of initiates. He's currently a college English professor at Olivet College in Michigan, and John is also an author. And tonight we're going to be talking about his book, H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magical Tradition. So welcome, John.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm anxious to hear all about this. I mean, I read the book and learned a lot, and there's just so much going on that people in the chat room are happy to hear about it, and I'm really glad that I said that you're here tonight. Now, I remember back in the 70s when many of my peers were either reading Carlos Castaneda or H.P. Lovecraft. Also, a few were reading Tolkien as well. At the time, I think I must have been busy with other things because I missed out on a lot of that, although I did read The Hobbit. But when did you first read a Lovecraft story, and what was it about him and his writing that drew you in?
Well, when I first started out, I've always been interested in ghosts, vampires, and werewolves and things like that. When I was in elementary school and in middle school, and what happened was I was like in a bookstore. It was a Read More bookstore, and this was when I was in middle school. And I saw a book. It was just a paperback book, and it had a really lurid cover. It had like a orange skull on it with flames around it, and it was The Color Out of Space and Other Stories by H.P. Lovecraft. I'd never read anything by Lovecraft before, but quite frankly, I bought the book because of the cover. You know, The cover was so lurid, you know, I said, this guy has some good stories in it. And so this was on actually a nice spring day, and I'd be in a habit, like after school, I'd sit out on the playground. Sometimes in the autumn, I'd go to the cemetery and read because I like reading outside, especially in the autumn time. But this was in the springtime, and I read The Color Out of Space, and for some reason, the story really terrified me. I mean, here it was, like full sunlight, nice warm day, and I had chills running up and down my spine. After that, you know, I just was kind of hooked on Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm. It'll do it. You know, he's been called the father of modern horror and one of the most influential writers of the 20th century. But here was a man who was shy and reclusive and received very little exposure or acclaim during his lifetime. How and when did his tremendous popularity come into be?
Well, what happened, like, Lovecraft thought that he was a complete failure. When he died, he had gotten stories only published in small pulp magazines like Weird Tales. And he'd never gotten a book published. He was never in hardcover print at all. And when he died, he thought that it was just all over with, basically. He thought he just didn't accomplish anything. But what happened was, you're right about him being reclusive, but he was a very prolific letter writer, and he had correspondence with people from all over the United States and Europe, too. And a lot of these people he corresponded with really got to know him just through the letters, and they really kind of loved him. You know, I mean, he was a very lovable person, even though he was kind of reclusive from a personal standpoint. And what happened was, is one of his best friends, August Derleth, who was also a Weird Tales writer, after Lovecraft died, he thought it was kind of outrageous that Lovecraft had no reputation at all. And so he founded the publishing house, Arkham House, which is still publishing today. And he did it for the sole reason of getting Lovecraft in hardcover books. And that was his goal. He got Lovecraft in hardcover books. And then after that, Lovecraft slowly began to get recognized over time. But if it hadn't been for Derleth, we probably wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. I probably wouldn't have even written the book. He would have just been viewed as a minor pulp tale writer back in the 1920s and 30s.
And I read where he died in poverty, right?
He died in poverty. And he, like I say, he thought he was a complete failure. But what happened then, like during the 70s, he was in print because Arkham House was keeping him alive. And then what happened was the armed forces very nicely put forth these little paperback books to distribute to the troops in the various wars. And that kind of kept him going, too, because he was getting disseminated a little bit more. And then finally, around the 1980s, the critics started getting a hold of him. And then in the 80s and 90s, S.T. Joshi, who incidentally is one of the people that endorsed my book, he got a hold of Lovecraft, and he did like so much single-minded labor to get Lovecraft recognized by the critical and the literary community, that it's largely due to his efforts now that Lovecraft actually is being accepted among most colleges and universities and critics as being a major author, comparable to Edgar Allan Poe and Nathaniel Hawthorne and other writers.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm going to start with some of the questions from chat, because there are a lot of them, and then I can ask my questions in between. So we're probably going to be skipping around a little bit.
Fine.
But Ceiling Cat was talking about the dreams that Lovecraft used to have. And unfortunately, half of what she wrote got taken up in the chat thing. But he apparently had a lot of dreams. And what's left of this, and maybe you'll pick up here, what's left of what she wrote was, he was with a friend named Loveberg, and they were exploring a crypt. And Loveberg went in first with a rope, and Lovecraft heard a scream. He yelled out, "Are you all right?" And a demonic voice answered, "Loveberg's dead, you fool." Imagine that kind of dream life. So you know what she's talking about, right?
Yeah, it's called The Statement of Randolph Carter. It's one of Lovecraft's earlier works. It's not Loveberg, by the way. What it was the character's name was Warren. Warren, and then I forget the other guy's names. They were fictitious characters, but she was saying Loveberg, but it's actually Love Man, and Love Man was actually a friend of Lovecraft's. His name was Samuel Loveman, and him and Lovecraft actually were staying in a cemetery one time, and that's where Lovecraft got the deal. It's kind of confusing because you got all these loves here, right? Lovecraft,
right.
Love Man, and this person that you wrote in said Loveberg, but the man's name was actually Love Man, but Lovecraft changed the names, of course, for his story. And what it was the guy descended into the crypt, and then at the end, of course, he was in communication with a guy, kind of like through a walkie-talkie, kind of a radio. And then at the end, he heard the line just saying, "You fool, Warren is dead." And so obviously there was some being down there talking to him, and his friend Warren was presumably dead. So it was kind of a very minor horror story, but very effective. That last line was very effective.
Yeah, I've read a couple of his stories, and he gives good visuals. You know, in what you read, the mind can perceive. Sometimes you have to think hard about what you're reading, and in this case, you don't. The other thing she wanted to ask about was his poetry. At the age of 5, under the name of the Abdul Hazad, the author of the Necronium?
Yeah, the Abdu'l Hazred, it was, and that was a fictitious character, and it's called the Necronomicon.
And
that's a fictitious book, too. But what was your question specifically about the Necronomicon?
Well, it was his poetry at the age of five.
Oh, well, he wrote poetry, of course, at a very early age, but most of his poetry is kind of like based on 18th and 17th century poets, and it's not very good, actually. His poetry is just not quite good. But he started moving toward fiction later on, like when he was in his 20s and his late 20s, and he started moving more toward fiction, you know. So he moved away from the poetry. But the Abdu'l Hazred and the Necronomicon, he created that, the fictional author and the fictional book, and then he kind of made use of it in his fictions later on. So he developed a whole history of the Necronomicon. And I discuss that, by the way. You said you read the book. I discuss in chapters 3 and 4 the various versions of the Necronomicon. Because, like in my book, my goal in this book is to write a volume for not specifically New Age people or people that know about magic or the magical systems, but basically for science fiction and fantasy fans who are actually curious about Lovecraft's connection with Western occultism. And that's my target audience. You'll notice, like if you've got a copy of the book, you'll notice that all my praise at the beginning of the book, all these people, they've written endorsements for me, except for S.T. Joshi, of course. He's a scholar. But the rest of them, they're all like leading science fiction, fantasy, and horror writers. And that's my target audience, because a lot of these people are kind of curious. They hear all sorts of nonsense about Lovecraft, like whether he was a practicing magician, whether he actually was in touch with real gods and goddesses, that sort of thing. And so the book actually kind of clears the ground and clarifies all those issues. And in chapters 3 and 4, I go into detail about the actual Necronomicons, what it is, and which ones could be accepted as perhaps a genuine Necronomicon, and which ones shouldn't be accepted as that. So that's all kind of dealt with in chapters 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you mentioned a little bit of magic. So when did you actually become interested in magic, and did any of Lovecraft's writing inspire you to become a magical practitioner?
Oh, it sure did. You know, when I first started out doing magic, I was starting out, and I spell it with a K, of course, to kind of distinguish it from the sleight of hand. What happened was I'd always been fascinated by magic, and in high school I was doing magical rituals, but there was always something missing. You know, I've always had kind of a natural talent for it, and I remember we'd go out there, we'd go to cemeteries or to wilderness areas, and we'd get results, okay? I remember we evoked the spirit of Bart Sabell one time. Bart Sabell is like a Martian entity, and it came up there. Like, we could actually see it. Everybody could see it in the magical group. But in the back of my mind, I was saying, well, this is just too easy. You know, I mean, there it was, standing there. It looked like a spirit that you would expect to be associated with Mars, the way it was dressed, the way it was acting. But I just couldn't help thinking in the back of my mind that that was just something I created in my own mind and just embodied it. And I wasn't thinking it was something real, that I was actually genuinely in touch with anything extraterrestrial in the fuller sense. And what happened was, then I slowly, when I got into college, I got into Lovecraft, and then I started writing rituals based on the Lovecraftian mythos. And I got to tell you, the very first ritual that I did, it was Evocation of Cthulhu. I had incredibly remarkable results, and there was no question after that I was actually in touch with something that was not based on my own human-centric things, but actually something other than me, something outside myself. And then after that, I just exclusively dealt with these kind of entities because I felt that I was actually in touch with something real, something genuine.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to what you might have thought initially, that it was the thought form or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, their thought forms have their place, certainly. Excuse me. Thought forms have their place, but I was in touch with something that was just not me. That's what the whole idea. I wanted something actually extraterrestrial. And then I've written a series of rituals over the years that actually do work. And somewhere down the road, I might actually publish those too. But I'm kind of involved with this Lovecraft, my Lovecraft trilogy right now. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, so now we know how Lovecraft influenced you. How did his stories influence modern occultism and people like Anton LaVey, Kenneth Grant, and actually link him to Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, well, that's what I deal with. Like, if you read the book, in the latter half of the book, after chapter 6, I think it's chapter 6, let's see here, chapter 5, the whole latter half of the book is Lovecraft's direct influence on the black magical systems. Mm-hmm. And I define the black magical systems, and this sometimes irritates people. I remember I did a book signing, and there was a Wiccan lady sitting next to me, and she didn't like the fact that the book was the black magical tradition because of the evil associations. Most people think black is evil. I mean, that's actually a very human-centric view, too, but black being evil, white being good. But the reason why I associate Lovecraft with black magic is because I define black magic is simply magic being performed for two purposes, either knowledge or power. And this is good knowledge, and it's good power, not dominating people, not having power over people, but good knowledge and good power, while I define white magic as simply magic being performed for spiritual perfection. And Lovecraft had tremendous, and he's still having tremendous influence on the black magical systems. And in my book, I define those as being the voodoo religion, of course, which is probably the oldest form of religion we have, based on serpent worship. And then the Wiccan religion, of course. And then Satanism. I have chapter 9 that deals with Lovecraft's influence on Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. And then, of course, Kenneth Grant's Typhonian system, which is kind of an offshoot of Aleister Crowley's OTO. And then finally, the Chaos Magic Packs. So the whole latter half of the book explores those kind of direct connections there. So that's a primary element of my book. I want to show exactly how he has an influence on these systems and how he continues to have an influence right up into the 21st century.
Exactly. And, you know, when you talk about magic being black or white, I believe it's neither. You know, it's individual to each practitioner and how they decide they would like to focus it. And in the duality of it all, you can't have dark without light. You can't have good without evil. You know, on it goes.
Yeah, but think about it for a minute. Like, people associating black with evil. Evil, a person's evil based on only two things, either their behavior or the kind of person they are. So a person could actually be a white magician. They could be devoted to, like, spiritual perfection, but they could still be a very evil person. And then a person could be a black magical practitioner, interested in knowledge and power, but they could be a very ethical, wonderful person, too. So good or evil is dependent on the human being themselves, and you make the judgments based on behavior, but not on the type of magic they perform. Magic is beyond considerations of good or evil.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that's kind of the way I try to explain it to people, that it just is. Magic just is, and it depends on who's doing it as to the outcome and their intention. And that's, I think, kind of the simplest way to explain it, in a sense. But in Lovecraft's work, he views the practitioner as definitely black, but not necessarily, like you said, not necessarily evil. And that some of his characters end up becoming evil, but that seems to be besides the point, right?
That is exactly beside the point. He has some magical practitioners, like Eric Zahn, for instance, in the music of Eric Zahn. And this gentleman's a blind violinist, and he's using his violin like a magical instrument. And I define magic as the use of language, gestures, symbolic objects, and stylized settings to achieve contact with extraterrestrial entities. And his symbolic object, of course, is the violin. He uses a language, he creates a music, and he does this whole magical system that he has going mainly for knowledge and power, but there's not an evil bone in the guy's body. And there are several magical practitioners in Lovecraft that are just like that. And then on the other hand, there are the evil black magical practitioners too, you know. So you get both in Lovecraft.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, there's another duality. It's a good thing. Was Lovecraft himself a practicing occultist, as some devotees believe, or like some other authors who have written books about magic, and I'm just throwing in J.K. Rowling because it's the most common one these days, and I'm not making a comparison of the two by any means, but was Lovecraft strictly a creative and imaginative writer who perhaps did some research into occult traditions, or was he hands-on?
Yeah, well, I actually talk about that issue completely in Chapter 2. After you read Chapter 2, you know everything you want to know about Lovecraft, what he knew about magic, and what he believed about magic. Lovecraft was basically a materialist and an atheist, and so he didn't believe in anything existing apart from matter and the facts of existence. He considered himself a mechanist materialist, he called himself. So he denied the existence of gods or goddesses, and if he denied that, then he denied, of course, the things that fuel magical rituals. But what you got to realize, and you touched upon this earlier, you mentioned duality, right? And this other lady that did the question, she was talking about the dreams, right? That was only one facet of Lovecraft, the materialistic and atheist side. There was also that very, and I call this the kind of dark night or the night side of Lovecraft. This was a Lovecraft that actually had these vivid dreams and had a very deep interest in weird themes, weird literature, and occult themes. And so that Lovecraft actually started developing creative composition and started writing the stories. So Lovecraft was a very deeply divided person. There was a light side and there was a dark side, the rational and then the irrational. And I would argue that at no time in his life, right up until when he died in 1937, he never reconciled that duality. And because of that, that's why his work is so strong and so vibrant today, because he gives us, on the one hand, these very vivid, powerful images and narratives, but on the other, it's based also in his rationality and his atheism, and so you get a more sophisticated form of gods and goddesses and of alternate dimensions as well that are in total conformity with the views of quantum physicists today. So he's very relevant, very vibrant, and very connected with the 21st century right now.
Mm-hmm. It's perfect. I mean, he was way ahead of his time, obviously. In all of his works, how often did Lovecraft actually feature black magic?
Some people like S.T. Joshi he makes the argument that Lovecraft was moving away from the occult, moving away from magic, and that he eventually demythologized his entities and then viewed them strictly as aliens as opposed to beings living in alternate dimensions. But I got to tell you something, if you look at Lovecraft's work, that never happened. You know, the magical backstory, the magical themes persist all the way up to the end. In some stories, you know, it'll be a little bit more like science fiction, like The Color Out of Space or The Shadow Out of Time. But then right after he writes a story like that, he'll write a story that gets us back into magic and occultism and the alternate dimensions again and the gods and goddesses. And he would just jump back and forth between the two. So at no point in his life did he actually move away from that. And the reason why I think S.T. Joshi argues that way is because Joshi is an atheist himself, and he likes to think that Lovecraft was kind of like him, and he was kind of like believing like him. But you can't pin Lovecraft down to that at all. You know, one minute you think you got him pinned down, and then suddenly he's somewhere else. And that, again, makes him relevant today. That's why we're reading him. That's why he's got all these games based on his systems. Why we have Cthulhu Mythos literature being continually written today. Why they're making movies out of him. You know, I mean, because you can't pin him down. There's something for nearly everyone in Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm. And talking about the Cthulhu's mythos, and I mentioned this to you earlier, but it was really strange this week that going over, and I like what the answer you gave me, so I want to hear that again. While I was going over things and making a few notes for tonight's show, I came across the word Cthulhu, and looking at the spelling, you know, there's no way that you can actually really wrap your head around it and say it right. So, you know, your book has been called a compelling and unusual study of its mythos, Cthulhu's, and I'm sure when I went in search of pronunciations, I came up as empty as when I started, because you know on the web you can ask for pronunciations, and they'll actually audio give them to you. And I went to like four or five of Cthulhu things. None of it sounded like Cthulhu. You know, everybody had their own take on it.
Yeah.
YouTube is full of it. And then, like I said earlier, to put the icing on the cake, I found a note written by Lovecraft himself saying that the name of the hellish entity was invented by beings whose vocal organs were not like man's. Hence, it has no relation to the human speech equipment. The syllables were determined by a physiological equipment wholly unlike ours, hence could never be uttered perfectly by human throats. I read that and I thought, I give up. I'm never going to know how to pronounce it the right way. So, you explained earlier to me about what he meant by what he was writing about, how the names come up.
Yeah, well, anybody can pronounce it any way they want. That's the beauty of it, you know. I mean, what he's doing by creating entities like that, he's challenging our perceptions. In fact, right now there are a whole school of philosophers called speculative realists that claim that we cannot know reality at all. Our own human perceptions and instruments get in the way. And that view, incidentally, is shared by quantum physicists as well. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying is that we can't really understand reality at all. We can kind of approximate by analogy or perhaps by cubist methods of appreciation, but we can't really understand at all. And Lovecraft's creation of these entities and even the very pronunciation of their words kind of reflect that, because they're just approximations towards something that we don't have the mechanism to really fully understand.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of chuckling as I was going, because I was really going to, you know, study up and I was going to get it right. And by
well, you can't get it right, but that's the whole
point. I didn't
point,
know that.
You know?
Yeah, uh-huh.
No human being can get it right, according to speculative realists and according to quantum physicists. There's something even wrong about us wanting to get it right. That's what they would argue. And this whole and these philosophers right now are putting Lovecraft at the forefront of Western philosophy because of that view. And if you ever notice, like, look at sometime you talk about the pronunciation of Cthulhu, look at the call of Cthulhu, which is the story where Cthulhu appears. Look at sometime when you get a chance, read his description of Cthulhu. And what you're going to find is that he's not really defining it clearly at all. What he's doing is he's giving us various analogies to other things, but he's not really telling us what this is at all, because, quite frankly, we can't really comprehend it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in that respect, when you say it like that and you think about it, it makes sense, yet it doesn't kind of compute to a lot of people. Because most people look in the black and white, and there's either a way to understand or there isn't, kind of thing. So,
well, they've been taught, they've been trained to look at things a certain way, like they're gods too. How do people think of gods? Like when they think of God, they usually visualize some kind of paternalistic thing with a white beard, right? A Dumbledore, Albus Dumbledore, you know. J.K. Rowling's got the perfect image of God. Just put him in right profile. It's Albus Dumbledore, right? When they think of Jesus, they've got very clear pictures of Jesus, right? He's kind of a good-looking guy with long brown hair, usually a halo around him. The problem is that we're conditioned to view gods and goddesses like that, and I think it's a weakness of mankind to do that, because what we're saying is that we're kind of afraid of what's out there, and so we create these things to kind of stand between us and the out there. And these things are to make us feel more comfortable about. And the best way to feel comfortable is thinking that they're like us in a lot of ways. They look like us. Mm-hmm. They're more powerful than us. But they're basically us. They're like friends. They're like neighbors and stuff like that. Lovecraft challenges that whole view. He believed that in something called cosmic indifferentism, where man is out there all by himself. There are no benign gods or goddesses to watch over us, and that eventually everything's going to get wiped out, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's a very bleak view of the cosmos, but unfortunately, or fortunately perhaps, it reflects a view of modern science right now and of most rational thinkers right now in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, isn't it? Or maybe not. I mean, you know, it's deep. It's really deep to think of it that way.
Well, that's the way Lovecraft thought about it. You know, and I would argue that he's probably one of the finest minds of the 20th and the 21st centuries. And like I mentioned before, I've got a trilogy of books going here. This was my first one. I kind of cleared the air with the magical systems. The second one, I just put the finishing touches on last week, so that one's all written. And then I've got a third one, too. It's going to take me these three books to kind of try and explicate Lovecraft's great mind. And you know what? I have a suspicion when I'm done with all three books, and I've got two of them done now, I have a feeling that I'm still not going to be able to exhaust the wonders of that beautiful mind. This mind is equivalent or superior to any other person's mind I can think of. I'm talking about Stephen Hawking, Einstein, every one of them.
And yet, interestingly enough, and whether this has anything to do with anything, but both his parents actually they died in the same insane asylum, correct?
Yeah, they did. What happened is father actually developed some form of syphilis, And back then, you know, syphilis would lead to insanity. You know, they really couldn't cure it. They could use silver nitrate to stay. So he ended up in a mental institution. His mother, Susie, was kind of a obsessive compulsive, kind of a neurotic woman. And then she started behaving a little oddly, too. And so she actually ended up in the same institution that Lovecraft's father did. So you're right. They both end up in mental institutions. There wasn't any evidence through Lovecraft's whole life that there was any kind of mental instability on his part at all. So,
no, in the article that I read on that, they just said that circumstances, because of both of them in that situation, no doubt contributed to Lovecraft's fractured view of the world, in their opinion.
Yeah, well, I would disagree they had a fractured view of the world. He had a very sheltered kind of growing up and stuff, but I think he had a very wide view of the world. He had his own idiosyncrasies, of course, and quite frankly, the man was a bit of a racist. You know, there's no way to get around that. He was, a lot of people back in his time were racist also. That doesn't justify it, because there are always people that can rise above that, no matter what time period or whatever generation. But he was a bit of a racist. He didn't like what he called alien cultures. And again, the duality of Lovecraft comes in, because there are some stories that are driven by this kind of attitude toward immigrant cultures coming in. One of his stories, The Horror at Red Hook, which he wrote when he was living in New York, that brings in kind of his worst views of like some of the immigrant cultures around the Brooklyn area of New York. And yet it makes it very vivid too, because he absolutely detested certain types of people. He didn't like the way they looked. He didn't like the way they sounded. He didn't like anything about them without even knowing anything about them at all. And so that kind of gave a little bit more power to his works. But what people don't realize about Lovecraft is he wasn't so down on the people per se, but what he didn't like was what he saw like a weakening or diluting of Western culture, and he was afraid that culture would be depleted and diluted to such an extent where it wouldn't be strong anymore. And that was one of his greatest fears, and that kind of fueled his racism.
I think a lot of people feel the same way, and it fuels theirs as well.
Yes, it does.
In the PR package that came with the book, there is a sentence that I'd like to explore a little bit further. Many well-known scholars, artists, and writers perceive Lovecraft as more than just a writer of horror fiction. They believe he is a key figure in the history and evolution of Western culture as a whole. Now, that's big.
Yeah, it is. It certainly is big. And let's look at that for a minute. You know, I mean, what I do, what I argue is that Lovecraft... the reason why we should study Lovecraft is because, for a lot of reasons, but first of all, from a literary standpoint, you know, I would argue that he's a very top literary figure. And I'm not just talking about just weird literature or horror fiction or anything, but he's just as important as like Poe, Hawthorne, Herman Melville. And his literary themes and his genres are just as important, too. And I would argue, though, that in addition to the literary influence, you'll notice that he spawned a whole subcategory of literature as well, the Lovecraftian fiction or Cthulhu mythos fiction. Now, people are writing this stuff today. In fact, S.T. Joshi comes out, like, it seems like every 6 months he comes out with a new anthology of this kind of fiction. And these things are being written by a lot of the people that gave me an endorsement. So these are leading science fiction, horror, and fantasy writers right now. They're continuing on that tradition. Now, that's important, first of all. You're talking about a major literary figure who's actually spawned a literary genre. There aren't too many writers you can say that about. Hawthorne, Melville, great writers, even Poe, but they didn't really spawn any genres of their own. So that's one component. Let's look at another component. A guy named Jason Colvado has come out with a book called The Cult of Alien Gods, and what he argues is that Lovecraft's work has inspired the whole UFO phenomenon and the contactee, the alien astronaut theories, and that's still an important part of our culture, right? And then we've got Graham Harman, who's actually... professor over at the American University in Cairo in Egypt, and he places Lovecraft equivalent to Western philosophers like Martin Heidegger and even artists like Picasso and C.S. Lovecraft as a pivotal figure in ontology, the science of ontology. And then I've already mentioned his popular cultural roots as well, you know, where he's actually spawned the whole popular culture, the games, the movies, and everything else. So when you think about, look at all those contributions. I mean, it's a very widespread contribution all the way across different dimensions of Western culture. And I, quite frankly, can't think of any other person who's had that wide of an influence. I mean, if I was going to put somebody forth for the Nobel Prize in Literature, I would put forth Lovecraft, because I can't think of too many Nobel Prize laureates who have actually had more of an influence on our general culture than H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, there are people that I've talked to that had never heard of him, and then other people, like I said, jump up and down knowing that we were going to talk about him tonight.
Yeah.
He's still not out there, I think, in some areas, but I do know that everybody knows, as far as I am concerned, everybody knows the name. And I think that's what kind of got me in the 70s. You know, that name was just, whoa, what a neat name kind of thing. You know, I think people thought it was a made-up name, you know, a pseudonym. He was writing under, you know, an assumed name or something. But even back then, people were just very almost willing to bow down to him at that time.
I've heard a lot of crazy things. I was at a book signing about a month ago, and some guy came up. He didn't know anything about Lovecraft, but he thought the name Lovecraft, he thought that Lovecraft was like some kind of sex guy or something. And he thought that he had like some kind, he was a pimp or something, and had this whole stable of prostitutes. He had this whole mythology worked out just because of Lovecraft. And I mean, you're sitting there and you're trying to keep a straight face. You kind of want to sell books. And I didn't really know how to respond to that at all. But you're right. You know, the funny thing about, like, when you write about this kind of stuff and research it, you don't realize sometimes that you're kind of in a niche. Like, I'm in a niche market here. And outside that niche market, there might be a lot of people that don't know anything about Lovecraft at all. So I have to be kind of reconciled to that. I mean, so you're right. You know, some people, I think most people have kind of heard of him. If they haven't read a word of any of his writings, at least they probably heard the name, or they know kind of vaguely that he writes horror stories and something. But you're right, there are people out there that probably don't know anything about him at all. And then you got to remember something else, too, the racism angle. I mean, that's mm-hmm. hurt Lovecraft tremendously.
Yeah, I imagine it would. But it was just like he, Castaneda, and Tolkien were the three that I remember that people were reading.
Yeah, I read all those people. You know, Castaneda, he was kind of exposed as kind of a hoax. The Don Juan books, mm-hmm. I believe mm-hmm. that those were all kind of just fictionalized. They were still real good reading. I remember reading those when I was in college at MSU, Michigan State University. As for mm-hmm. Tolkien, I read him too. But notice Tolkien for a minute. He's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. He's got mm-hmm. this Middle Earth kind of a thing, and it's all very comfortable, charming, human-centric. I mean, he's got like dark lords dressed in black, and then the good magicians dressed in white. I mean, it's still the old standard human-centric mm-hmm. kind of thing that you used to get back in the works of Edgar Rice Burroughs and writers like that, where they just, everything kind of takes on a human kind of cast, reflecting, of course, their own insecurities about their place in the cosmos. And you'll notice that out of all those writers that you've mentioned there, only Lovecraft has gone beyond that to a more kind of sophisticated view of the cosmos. As for J.K. Rowling, I mean, I love the Harry Potter books. They're among my favorite books. I usually reread those, the last four of them, I usually reread those at least once a year, right? So I love those mm-hmm. books. But you got to think, you know, those are very human-centric, too. I mean, Voldemort, you know, the mm-hmm. Dark Lord dressed in black. There it is again. It's the same in mm-hmm. the black. And then Dumbledore, you know, he would wear these beautiful kind of spangled blue robes with the wizard's hat. He had the white beard, so he's the good magician, mm-hmm. the bad mm-hmm. magician, and then good versus evil. I mean, I realize that they're geared primarily for young readers or pre-adult readers, but still, you know, it's that old black versus white dichotomy again that you get, you know. So out of all the writers that we talked about, Lovecraft is the only one that pushes beyond that and pushes into the realms of the sophisticated realms of quantum physics and the quantum view of the universe. The only one.
And I think that may scare some people off, because if they've heard anything about him, you know, sometimes you mention quantum physics to somebody and they run in the other direction.
Right.
They, you know, it's way over their head and they're afraid that they're not going to be able to understand or not understand his writing or not understand what he's trying to get across, because they're going to think they missed something.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
people are afraid of that, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's not really trying to get anything across at all. What he's doing is what any writer does. They're kind of fascinated by things. They're fascinated by things in their mind. And they simply explore their fascinations when they write. I don't think a writer sits down consciously and said, I'm going to create this because I'm trying to make this statement or that statement. A lot of literary critics will say that. They'll say, well, they're writing, they're doing this or that. But I think deep down, when you do creative writing, you're just exploring things that fascinate you, sometimes things that scare you, some things that intrigue you. And Lovecraft doesn't make any demands for you to actually have to be real highbrow or real intelligent to appreciate him. What he does is he just simply gives you some wonderful images, some strong narrative prose, and then he simply allows you to experience that. And if you just kind of sit back and experience it, and you don't try and extrapolate too much from it, it's thoroughly entertaining. You know, you don't have to bring anything to Lovecraft at all. He's going to give you the images and the incidents, and then you just simply sit back and just kind of enjoy them and be inspired by them, be terrified by them, whatever reaction you want to bring to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's just a comment in the chat room that Colin Wilson in The Mind Parasites understood the parapsychology of the dark, was also influenced by Lovecraft.
Yeah, it's amazing how wide, like I said, it's amazing how wide his influence has been. And my book, of course, explores just the influence on Western occultism. And there's another development. You know, I mean, I talked before about his influences when I was talking about the Nobel Prize stuff, which probably mm-hmm. won't happen, but it would be nice if you could get it. But my book even explores the occult, you know, so when you think about, you know, it's just his reach across Western culture is immense, and it shows no sign of lessening, you know. As we go into the 21st century, it seems like he's as popular as ever, and I can't visualize him ever becoming not popular.
No, and the thing of it is, too, we as people are getting a little bit more open-minded as time goes by. We're open to a lot of things that people might not have been 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. So that is in Lovecraft's favor, I believe, because people will meet him. He'll read them. They'll explore him. And as you said, then it just kind of goes from one to the other, and I think it'll always keep on going.
Yeah, well, one thing about Lovecraft I think is important, too. I think his influence on occultism is going to continue to grow. I mean, there's so much activity in the Satanist community today. There's so many new Satanist groups going up. They're heavily influenced by Lovecraft. The OTO, I used to be a member of the OTO, Aleister Crowley's OTO, they're influenced by Lovecraft. That's going to continue on. But what I find kind of intriguing about Lovecraft is I have a conviction that someday, down the road, science is going to have to kind of adopt Lovecraft too, because quite frankly, science is very wonderful, but science has a big, big problem. They can't quantify what their speculations. I mean, you've got the quantum physicists, they have all these beautiful views of the cosmos and the sub-molecular and subatomic levels, but there's no way that they can actually extrapolate that to the real world, the Newtonian world, and unless they can do that, the findings of quantum physics is not really too relevant. You know, I mean, because you can't do anything with it. I mean, you can use it to predict, like, what electrons are doing it, and you can make measurements, like if you want to measure the ratio between the spin of an electron and then maybe its magnetic charge, you can do that with, like, pinpoint accuracy, but what you can't do anything else. Like, mankind wants to do other things. Like, I'm pretty sure that someday our sun's going to blow out. It's going to turn nova and then it's going to expire. We need to colonize other planets. And quantum physicists can't help us with that because they can't quantify any of their nice speculations. But Lovecraft will actually help them go that way, because they're going to have to go back to their roots in order to quantify these things. And when I talk about their roots, I'm talking about magic, magical roots.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make any sense? I sometimes talk.
And, no, it did, actually.
And I have to actually slow down and say, wait a minute, do I even know what I'm saying? You know, I hope that made sense, whatever I said.
That was a very Lovecraftian comment just now. Yeah, exactly. I read another interesting thing. I do a little homework, and sometimes I get led astray, and sometimes, you know, it's right on. But I read somewhere where H.P. Lovecraft collaborated with Harry Houdini.
Yeah, he sure did. What happened, it wasn't really much of a collaboration. Houdini was a great illusionist, you know, a great magician, but the kind of magician that you spell with a C rather than a K at the end. And what happened was he was very well known at that time. He wanted to, they wanted to kind of capitalize on his name, so the person that was running Weird Tales magazine, they asked Harry Houdini to write a story to be published in Weird Tales. And Houdini couldn't write, of course. I mean, he was basically a man of action, but he couldn't write. And so he had kind of like a rough idea about like some weird incidents happening underneath the pyramids in Egypt. And so it was called Under the Pyramids. And so he sent the kind of his little workable thing to Lovecraft. And then Lovecraft basically wrote the story. And so I don't know if you'd call it a collaboration so much, because Lovecraft basically wrote it, and then it was published under the name of Houdini, and then H.P. Lovecraft, of course. And that, what sold the story, of course, was the fact that Houdini's name was attached to it. But I wouldn't really call it a collaboration per se.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was also, because people keep, again, talking about Cthulhu, and they're also talking about cosmicism. And there was a quote that I was looking at, and I'm trying to find where it was, because there was, it said, though most famous for his tentacled monsters, the driving force behind Lovecraft's work was less the ghouls themselves and more what they represented. The overwhelming vastness and incomprehensibility of the cosmos and the utter futility of mankind's attempt to be anything other than totally and utterly meaningless. You know, like, what a goth. And then it says, in other words, Dagon, if I'm pronouncing that right, does not want to eat you because Dagon is evil. Dagon wants to eat you because Dagon is hungry and you are totally insignificant. Which is a sentiment to which Lovecraft, as a starving, unappreciated author, was no stranger. What does that bring out of you?
This is what the literary critics claim now. They claim the cosmicism, and it's also called cosmic indifferentism, is Lovecraft's main contribution to literature. That's the thing that he does better than anybody, and only he can do it the way he does it. And what the belief is, it's actually a metaphysical kind of a view, that human life and human concerns, and in fact the Earth itself, is of total minimal significance in the great cosmos. And that furthermore, there's no real purpose or direction to human life, and there's certainly no divine oversight or direction guiding human affairs. And so kind of like we're on our own, basically. And it's a very bleak view and stuff, but when you think about the cosmos the way that science presents it to us now. We've got this tiny little planet here, and then we have a somewhat larger solar system than the universe, and then the general cosmos. And that kind of reflects what he's talking about. And when he says Dagon isn't interested in eating you so much, Dagon, like any one of his extraterrestrial entities, do not view man as being important at all. I mean, man's insignificant. Think about it, like when you go outside in the summertime. You're walking along, maybe along the grass or something. There's little ants down there, right? You don't sit down there and look at the ants. You might kill 100 ants while you're walking in the grass. It's so insignificant that you're not paying any attention to it at all, right? Well, this is the way Lovecraft extraterrestrial entities tend to view human and the human life and the Earth as being so insignificant that it's not something they even consider at all. You know, so it's a very bleak view of things, but that was Lovecraft's view. That was his contribution to literature, and it's a very bleak view. It's kind of like emo on the macrocosmic scale, if you want to look at it that way. But also, for some strange, inexplicable reason, it seems to kind of reflect what's out there. You know, it really does.
Mm-hmm. You know, the interesting thing, too, that I found, I'm finding lots of interesting things, is that I read where, you know, you would think that somebody that could get into your head and into quantum physics and all that stuff was extremely highly educated. And I found where H.P. Lovecraft never even graduated high school, right?
He sure did. He dropped out. He had all sorts of psychosomatic illnesses. His mother mm-hmm. kept pulling him out. And then he never finished high school. And that barred him his entire life, you know, and stuff. That doesn't bar me in the least. You know, I mean, when it comes to Lovecraft, I look at the works themselves and the kind of effects that they have. And like I've said many times, I mean, we're talking about weighty issues here, cosmicism and quantum physics. But if you read Lovecraft, that stuff isn't necessarily there unless you want to see it there. You know, so you can read mm-hmm. Lovecraft strictly as horror fiction and get a good thrill out of it. You don't have to. It doesn't challenge you intellectually unless you want it to, which is one right. thing that I like so much about. So everybody mm-hmm. can like it. But getting back to the high school kind of thing, you know, I'm very well educated myself. I have a master's in English literature from University of Virginia, and I have an MBA in accounting and finance from University of Wisconsin. So I'm pretty well educated, and I am a college professor. But you know what? When I encounter somebody like Lovecraft, I don't really care if he got a college education, if he graduated from high school. That's not something that concerns me at all. And quite frankly, I'm kind of glad that he did what he did, because I've got these works now, and he might not produce those works. Think about it. Like, maybe if he'd graduated from high school, he was always interested in science when he was a younger person, and he wrote a little column for the Arkham Advertiser or some newspaper where he wrote about astronomy and about the plants. Say that he graduated from high school, and then say that he went on to Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Great college, by the way. Say that he got a bachelor's degree in astrophysics or in astronomy or some quantitative field, right? And then he had his bachelor's degree. And then say he went back and taught high school, taught science in high school. Now, he probably would have been a lot happier of a guy if he'd done that. But would we have these works of art? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to tamper with anything they did, because I don't want to lose the works of arts. So, you know, I'm perfectly happy they didn't graduate from college or from high school. It doesn't bother me in the least. I don't care about racism either, because quite frankly, all I care about is these wonderful works of art. And I feel that if we changed any element of it, if he got his degree or if he wasn't a racist, if we changed any element of it, we might not have these wonderful works. And so I'm perfectly happy to just accept it the way it is. It doesn't bother me in the least.
Mm-hmm. And that's the right way to look at it, actually. Now, time is fleeting. It's flying by really fast.
It does.
It does. An hour is, especially on an interesting topic, turns into seemingly 10 minutes tops. But I would like you, before we get cut off here, to tell everybody where they can get a hold of the book, and also a website. You have a website where they can find out more about you and your writings and all the stuff that goes on in your life.
Okay, well, the book is in most bookstores across the United States and UK. No, but if you don't find it in your bookstores, they'll order it for you. But you can buy it on Amazon, of course. If you buy it on Amazon, it's a little cheaper than the amount that you pay at the bookstore, so you can order it on Amazon. You can order it on Barnes and Noble, and it's probably available all over the place. I mean, I don't really keep track of all the different websites and stuff. Mm-hmm. I've done a couple radio interviews, and people say, well, their people are buying it here and there, and I really don't keep track of all that kind of stuff, but it's out there any place you want to get it. You can always buy it from the Red Wheel Weiser website, the publisher themselves, you know. As for my website, it's www.johnlstedman.com. And if you go to that website, I have all the list of events. Like, I've been doing a lot of book signing around the country. A week and a half ago, I was actually in Chicago, so I travel around a little bit. I mean, I'm teaching full-time, so I have to fit into my teaching schedule, but I do these book signings, I do these radio interviews, of course, so all the events I have will be listed, like, under events there. In addition to that, I have, like, a little blog, too, and the blog is kind of attached to the website, so I'll tell you people about different events as well. If you go to the website, of course, there are links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Red Wheel, so you can order the book that way as well. And plus, I've got things like frequently asked questions about Lovecraft. I've got about 13 questions there. They'll actually clarify things about Lovecraft's likes and works. I have all the reviews, of course, and all my little things here at the front of the book here, all the praise from experts in the field and stuff. So that's all there, too. Mm-hmm. So you can find all that on www.johnlstedman.com. And what else did I want to say? I'm trying to think now. I got sidetracked, and I can't think of what I want to say. Oh, I wanted to say this to everybody aggressively, you know. I hope you'll all actually sample this book, because it'll actually tell you everything you need to know about Lovecraft's connection with the black magical tradition. But also, like I said before, I'm writing a trilogy. I just put the finishing touches on my second book in the trilogy, and I want to sell the second one, too, and I want to sell the third one, and the publishing company is a business. You know, I have a business degree, so I know exactly where they're coming from. They'll be glad to put up the money and sign a contract for the second one if I sell enough of the first one. So I have an axe to grind. You know, I mean, I have to confess I'm a little materialistic about that because of the business degree. But I want to keep the series going because, like I said, I want to explore them fully. And nobody can quite do it like me because of my magical background. Some writers explore Lovecraft, but they're atheists or they're materialists, and so they don't understand. They're not sensitive to the magical backstory. Other ones are too sensitive to the magical backstory, and then they start making outrageous claims like Lovecraft was associated with Aleister Crowley, and he was out there calling up demons and stuff. So they go the opposite extreme. I'm the golden mean between all those things, so I'm best equipped to deal with this. You know, so I want to sell these books, and I want to keep writing them.
Well, let's hope that This is one of the interviews that helps that happen. And in the meantime, we are going to toddle out of here. So I want to thank you for being a great guest tonight.
Thank you.
And, you know, when you get the second book out, give me a holler and we'll have you back on to talk about that. Because that goes into different aspects of it.
Yeah, I sure will. That one will be more like a literary critic kind of a thing. The definitive view of Lovecraft's works. I'm going to be looking at some very deeply at Lovecraft's individual works. So it's a big book. It's like 117,000 words as I finished it yesterday, which is pretty big. You know,
yes,
this one was only 90,000. So it's a little bit bigger than this one, but we're going to go into detail. I wanted to thank you very much for having me. You're a real sweetheart for doing that.
Well, you're very welcome, and I want to thank everybody for listening in tonight. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2014. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod. Licensed through Incompetech.com.